This is Audible.
Penguin Presents More Fool Me, written and read by me, Stephen Fry. Dedicated to Jo, my personal assister, and subject of simply the best decision I ever made in my entire life. In grateful thanks and with profuse apologies for all the extra work that this will bring. The fool doth think he is wise, yet it is the wise man that knows himself to be the fool. As You Like It, Act 5, Scene 1. The Past Won't Sit Still for a Moment. Jonathan Meads, 2014. There is nothing very appealing about show business memoirs. A linear chronology of successes, failures, and blind ventures into new fields is dull enough. And then there is the problem of how to approach descriptions of collaborators and contemporaries. She was adorable to work with, incredibly funny, and always intensely cheerful and considerate. To know her was to worship her. I was captivated by his talent, how marvellously he shone in everything he did. There was a luminosity, a kind of transcendence. She always had time for her fans, no matter how persistent they were. What a perfect marriage they had, and what ideal parents they were. A golden couple. I could there be describing actors, TV show presenters, or producers with total accuracy, leaving out only their serial polygamies, chronic domestic abuse, violent orgiastic fetishes, and breathtaking assaults on the bottle, the powders, and the pills. Is it right for me to be searingly, bruisingly honest about the lives of others? I'm quite prepared to be searingly, bruisingly honest about my own, but I just don't have it in me to reveal to the world that, for example, producer Ariadne Bristow is an aggressively vile, treacherous bitch who regularly fires innocent assistants just for looking at her the wrong way, or that Mike G. Wilbraham has to give a blowjob to the boom operator while finger-banging the assistant cameraman before he is prepared so much as to think about preparing for a scene. All these things are true, of course. But fortunately, Ariadne Bristow doesn't exist, and neither does Mike G. Wilbraham. Or do they? The actor Rupert Everett, in his autobiographical writings, manages to be caustic in what you might call a two-species manner, bitchy and catty. The results are hilarious, but I am far too afraid of how people view me to be able to write like that. Very happy to recommend both his volumes of autobiography memoir to you, however, Red Carpets and Other Banana Skins and The Vanished Years, ideal holiday or Christmas reading. So I now must consider how to present to you this third edition of my life. It must be confessed that this book is an act as vain and narcissistic as can be imagined. The third volume of my life story? There are plenty of wholly serviceable single-volume lives of Napoleon, Socrates, Jesus Christ, Churchill, and even Katie Price. So by what panty-dribbling right do I present a weary public with yet another stream of anecdote, autobiography, and confessional? The first I wrote was a memoir of childhood. The second, a chronicle of university and the lucky concatenation of circumstances that led to my being able to pursue a career in performing, writing, and broadcasting. Between the end of that second book and this very minute, the minute that I am now using to read this sentence, lies over a quarter of a century of my milling about on television, in films, on radio, writing here and there, getting myself into trouble one way or another, becoming a representative of madness, Twitter, homosexuality, atheism, annoying ubiquity, and whatever other kinds of activity you might choose to associate me with. I am making the assumption that in listening to this, you know more or less who I am. I am keenly aware, how could I not be, that if one is in the public eye, then people will have some sort of view. There are those who thoroughly loathe me. Even though I don't read newspapers or receive violent abuse in the street, I know well enough that there are many members of the British public, and I dare say the publics of other countries, who think me smug, attention-seeking, false, complacent, self-regarding, pseudo-intellectual, and unbearably irritating. diabolical. I can quite see why they would. There are others who embarrass me charmingly with their wild enthusiasm. They shower me with praise and attribute qualities to me that seem almost to verge on the divine. I don't want this book to be riddled with too much self-consciousness. There's a lot to say about the end of the 1980s and early 1990s, and you may find the way I go about it to be meandering. I hope a chronology of sorts will emerge as I bounce from theme to theme. There will inevitably be anecdotes of one kind or another, but it is not my business to tell you about the private lives of others, only of my own. I consider myself incompetent when it comes to the business of living life. Maybe that is why I am committing the inexcusable hubris of offering the world a third autobiography. Maybe here is where I will find my life, in this thicket of words, in a way that I never seem to be able to do outside the bubble I am in now as I write. Me, a keyboard, a mouse, a screen, and nothing else. Just loo breaks, black coffees, and an occasional glance at my Twitter and email accounts. I can do this for hours all on my own. So on my own that if I have to use the phone, my voice is often hoarse and croaky because days will have passed without me speaking to a single soul. So, where do we go from here? Let's find out. Catch up. I have a recurring dream. The doorbell sounds at 3 in the morning. I struggle out of bed and press the entry phone button.
Police, sir. May we come in?
Of course. I buzz them in. A series of charges that I cannot quite make out are chanted at me like psalms. I am arrested and cuffed. It is all very hurried and sudden, but entirely good-natured. One of the policemen asks for a photograph with me. We cut, as dreams so cinematically do, to a courtroom, where a much less sympathetic judge sentences me to 6 months' imprisonment with hard labour. He is disgusted that someone who should know so much better could have committed so foolish a crime and present so ignoble an example to the young, impressionable people who might errantly look up to him. He wishes the sentence could be longer, but he must abide by the guidelines laid down by statute. To the sound of mingled cheers and jeers, I am conducted down to the police cells and into the back of a van, which is delightfully decorated and exquisitely supplied with crystal, ice buckets, and an amazing array of alcoholic drinks.
Might as well get lashed, Stephen. Last drinks you're going to have for some while.
I'm at the prison. All the convicts have turned out to greet me. Their welcome is deafening and not in the least threatening. A vast dining hall. I sit to eat in a huge wide shot like Cody Jarrett as played by Cagney in White Heat. And then we see me in mid-shot, as cool and unruffled as Tim Robbins's ageless Andy Dufresne, taking my tray to the table. It is clear that I'm not in the joint for some appalling sexual or financial misdemeanour that will cause me to be beaten and tormented by my fellow convicts. I have done something that is wrong, that is disapproved of by society, yet which is tolerated with amusement by criminals and even police officers. Nobody lets me see the newspapers. They will only upset me, I am told. It is all very strange. Friends visit me, always staying the other side of the bars. Hugh and Joe Laurie, Kim Harris, my first lover, my literary agent Anthony, and my theatrical agent Christian, my sister and PA, Joe. There is something they are not telling me. But I am comfortable in prison, and feel sorry for them, having to leave and return to the world of bustle and business. I am in the corridor, cleaning the floor with an electric polisher. It has 2 rotating discs with gently abrasive pads press-studded to the base. And I enjoy holding it like a pneumatic drill, feeling its power under me, how I have to keep it from flying free of my grip as it pulls like an eager dog at the leash. The floor comes up in a glossy shine. This is the life. An old lag comes up to me, coughing on his tightly rolled up cigarette, which wags up and down as he speaks. He has seen a letter in the governor's office, which he pledges and tidies daily. My sentence is to be extended. I will never leave. I take the news well. Very well. I wake up. All the dream peters out or merges into something strange and silly and different. It is easy to attempt a little aneuromancy here. My real life is a prison, so a real prison would be an escape. That would be the one-line pitch, as they say in Hollywood. I am one who, like so many Britons of a certain class and era, was born to institutions. Schoolhouses merge into Oxbridge colleges, which merge into Inns of Court, or the BBC as it was, or into regiments, or ships of the line, or into one of the two houses of Parliament, or into the Royal Palaces, or into Albany, or the clubs of Pall Mall and St. James's. All very male, all very Anglo-Saxon. A few Jews allowed from time to time. It is vulgar to be racially obsessed. All very cosy, absurd, and out of date. If you really want to have a look at this world in its last hurrah, just before I was born, then you should read the first 8 or 9 chapters of Moonraker, a Bond novel, but with an opening that is simultaneously hilarious, fantastically observed, drool-worthily aspirational, and skin-pricklingly suspenseful. I observed of myself in my second book of memoirs, The Fry Chronicles, and earlier in my first, Moab is My Washpot, that I seem always to be obsessed with belonging. Half of me, I wrote in Moab, yearns to be part of the tribe. The other half yearns to be apart from the tribe. All the clubs I belong to, 6 so-called gentlemen's clubs, and goodness knows how many more Soho-style media watering holes, are vivid testament to a soul searching for his place in British society. Maybe prison is the ultimate club for people like me. That's institutionalized, as Morgan Freeman's Red puts it in The Shawshank Redemption, the world's favorite film. I am wary of interpretations. I refuse to interpret my life and its motives because I'm not qualified. You may choose to do so. You may find me and my history repugnant, fascinating, indicative of an age now long gone, typical of a breed whose time is up. There are all kinds of ways of looking at me and my story. If you want to bore someone, tell them your dreams. I seem to have got off on the wrong foot. I plead forgiveness for, while I would not claim that there is anything experimental about this memoir, I would ask you to be ready for a flitting backwards and forwards in time. The experience of writing about this period in my life has had some of the qualities of a dream. Unexpected, freakish, disgusting, frightening, incredible, and at one and the same time crystal clear and maddeningly occluded. It is my job, I suppose, in this far-from-divine comedy, to be Virgil to your Dante, guiding you as straightforwardly and tenderly as I can through the circles of my particular hell, purgatory, and heaven. In the following pages, I will try to be as truthful as I can. I will leave interpretation, and generally speaking, motivation, to you. Very naughty, but in the right spirit. Aside from anything else, there is the problem of plunging in as if you already know my past. Bertie Wooster, the hero and first-person narrator of P.G. Wodehouse's Jeeves stories, used to say to his readers at the beginning of each new book, something along the lines of, "If you are one of the old faithfuls familiar with previous episodes of my life as given to the world in the volumes Moab is My Washpot and The Fry Chronicles, now would be a good time to get on with a few odd jobs around the house. Go for a walk, wash the cat, get on top of the backlog in your email inbox, and so forth, while I fill in newcomers with the story so far." Only, of course, he would be referring not to Moab or the Chronicles, but to the Code of the Worcesters, say, or Right Ho Jeeves. And it is most unlikely that he would make any reference to inboxes. But you see the point. There is a faint chance that you might have come across the two predecessors of the memoir you are now holding in your ears, in which case I can imagine you tapping your foot with impatience when it comes to my ushering the uninitiated down old and well-trodden pathways. "Yes, yes, we know all that. Get on with it, man," I seem to hear you mutter from far away. "Let's come to the new stuff, the juicy bits. Scandal, showbiz, drugs, suicide, gossip." On several occasions, As I meet someone in that embarrassed wine-sipping huddle that always occurs before a dinner party, for example, they might tell me how much they thoroughly enjoyed such and such a book of mine. All fine and charming, if a little embarrassing. One never knows what to say, as Agatha Christie's alter ego, the popular author Ariadne Oliver, so splendidly played by Zoe Wanamaker in the television adaptations, often remarks. Anyway, an hour or so in, internally warmed by vinous glassfuls, I might tell, as one does around the dinner table, a story of some kind. I will notice the very person who confessed to admiring my book laughing heartily and whooping in surprise at the punchline. As they wipe the tears of infatuated merriment from their eyes, I will think to myself, hang on, that exact story is told word for word in the book they just assured me they liked so much. Either, therefore, they were lying about having read the book in the first place, which, let's face it, we've all done, so much easier not to read books, especially the books of one's friends, or, which is in fact quite as likely, if not more so, they have read it and simply forgotten just about every detail. What remains as one ages of a book is a smell, a flavour, a fleeting parade of sense images and characters, pleasing or otherwise. So I have learned not to be offended. One does not write expecting every sentence to be permanently branded into the memory of the reader. Far from being a curse, such memory leakages are actually rather a blessing. We all become, as readers, a little like the Guy Pearce character in the film Memento, only without the attendant physical jeopardies. Every day, a new adventure. Every rereading, a first reading. Every repeat, a first hearing. That is true, at least, of recently encountered books. I can recount almost word for word the Sherlock Holmes, Woodhouse, Wilde and Waugh that were the infatuations of my childhood, not to mention the Biggles, Enid Blyton and Georgette Heyer. But don't ask me to repeat the plot of the last novel I read. And it was a really good one, too. The Finkler Question by Howard Jacobson, which won a Booker Prize. I should have read it 2 or 3 years ago when it came out, but I'm hopelessly behind with contemporary fiction. Almost everything I read these days is history, biography, or popular science. I laid The Finkler Question down, finished from end to end, about 3 months ago, thoroughly satisfied. I remember laughing a lot. There was a racist mugging and a lot of very clever and compelling writing about anti-Semitism and all kinds of other delicious and wildly intelligent prose. But apart from the name Finkler and that incident, I honestly don't think I could tell you what happened in the book, only that I loved it. I'm way past the age when stories and even exact phrases and speeches stick. There are 17 steps up from pavement level to Holmes and Watson's 221B Baker Street rooms. The Edict of Nantes was revoked in 1685, and the Battle of Crecy was fought on the 26th of August, 1346. The precise day isn't that hard to fix in my brain, as it is my father's birthday. These and all kinds of irrelevant nonsenses I can reel off without recourse to Wikipedia. Exact phrases from Holmes, Jeeves, Mr. Micawber and Gimlet, Biggles's commando equivalent, come pouring back to me, especially French-Canadian private Trapper Troublet's habit of hissing sapristi whenever he was perturbed. I actually have a collection at home still of most of the works of Captain W. E. Johns, creator of Biggles and Gimlet, and of their female equivalent, the hearty and heroic Worrells of the Waff. In a satisfactory row, on my shelf at least, if not in publishing order, three of the Gimlet books are Gimlet Lends a Hand, Gimlet Bores In, and Gimlet Mops Up. Gay innuendo simply rocks. Even Monty Python couldn't do better than that, although their Biggles Flies Undone parody made me laugh so much when I first read it in one of the Python books, it gave me a serious asthma attack. True. It was the fact that they had so clearly read the books themselves with exactly the same attention to style and mannerism that I had that made me rock backwards, kicking my legs in the air in delight and wheezing like a dying emphysemiac. The point I suppose I'm trying to make is that I will have the enormous pleasure of reading Howard Jacobson's book again in a year or so as a fresh and new surprise. A friend of mine pointed out recently how absurd it was that people reread so little. Do you only listen to a piece of music that you love once? Anyway, shush. You're distracting me. The whole point of this opening section is to fill in the newcomers on the subject of La Vie Fryesque. And if you are listening to this and also know my previous stabs at autobiography, you have been warned. There will be repetition and possibly even self-contradiction. What I remember now may differ from what I remembered 5 or 10 years ago. But if you feel you know my life up until the ending of the Fry Chronicles and have no yearning for a redux reduction, then you may happily scroll through the tracks until you come to a bit you don't know. And then, meanwhile, get on with your little tasks about the home. Maybe settle into that TV box set you've always meant to get around to because everyone else seems to have watched it but yourself. Let me try, meanwhile, to run by the relevant earlier history of my life as briskly as I can. There is always the opportunity, I might add, for you to put this down right this very minute and immediately download or buy in hard copy Moab is My Washpot and The Fry Chronicles. Consume them in that order and save both of us all this repetition. But I wouldn't like to come over as greedy for sales. We're all above that kind of unpleasant mercantilism. So, where do I pick the story up from? From whence do I pick up the story? Whence do I pick up the story? Alistair Cook, the British journalist best known for his broadcasts from America for the BBC, once told me that when he was a very young man contributing material for the legendary C.P. Scott of the Manchester Guardian, he had submitted a piece of copy which included the phrase, "From whence?"
"Tell me, laddie," Scott had asked, tapping an angry pair of fingers on the offending phrase, "what does the word whence mean?"
From where?
Exactly. So you've just written from where? Tautology. Go and correct it.
Cook was foolish enough to stand up for himself. Shakespeare and Fielding both frequently used from whence.
Well, they wouldn't have done if they'd written for the Manchester fucking Guardian, said Scott.
So, while the others are still at their chores, let me pick the story up for the new arrivals. The others can pick it up whence I dropped it. Doesn't sound right to me, but there we are. Scott must have known what he was talking about. Our hero, after multiple scholastic expulsions... This is me I'm referring to now, not Alistair Cook or C.P. Scott. I'm attempting a paragraph of that Christopher Isherwood Salman Rushdie kind, where I refer to myself in the third person. It won't last long, I promise. After an adolescence steeped in folly, misery, heart-shredding mooncalf romance, and a short lifetime of wayward self-delusion and multiple crookedness, a sly, cocky, guileful, and self-fantasizing fool found himself imprisoned for credit card fraud and, still a teenager on the brink of a life of permanent failure, incarceration, familial exile, and squalid ignominy. He managed somehow to extricate himself from all this and acquire academic qualifications and a scholarship to Cambridge University. Well, he did not manage somehow. He broke through thanks to the combined wonders of flawlessly kind parents and to his own late discovery that he enjoyed academic work very, very much and could not bear the idea of missing out on a real education, especially amongst the stones and towers and courts of Cambridge, where heroes like E.M. Forster, Bertrand Russell, G.E. Moore, Ludwig Wittgenstein, Alfred Tennyson and William Wordsworth had pursued their silly games, rigorous work, lyrical sodalities, sentimental friendships, and semi-serious sacra conversazione, reading earnest and intellectually powerful papers from hearthrugs while nibbling anchovies or sardines on toast and being touched up by dons recruiting for MI6 or the KGB. That Jonathan Miller and Peter Cook of Beyond the Fringe and John Cleese, Graham Chapman and Eric Idle of Monty Python and Tim Brooke Taylor, Graham Garden and Bill Oddie of The Goodies, let alone Jermaine Greer, Clive James, Douglas Adams, Derek Jacobi, Ian McKellen, Peter Hall, Richard Eyre, Nicholas Heitner and so on, had also been at that same university, eating up the stage generations before me, was a less self-conscious inducement. Although I suppose, if I am honest, a small part inside of me did somewhere dream of fame and recognition in an as-yet inchoate form. You do not, I believe, grow up, even if you are Stanislavski, Brando or Olivier, knowing that you are a great actor. Much less do you grow up believing that you have it in you to make any kind of a career out of performance on stage or screen. Everyone has always known that it's an overcrowded profession. We're most of us these days, I suppose, familiar with the tenets of Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers, the story of success, which quite cogently argues that no one ever made a success of themselves without having put in at least 10,000 hours of practice before breaking through. No one. Not Mozart, not Dickens, not Bill Gates, not the Beatles. Most of us have instead put in 10,000 hours of wishing. And certainly, as far as acting was concerned, I had long thought I would like to take a stab at it, but hadn't gone much further than that. I think my first print review, Young Stephen Fry as Mrs. Higgins Would Grace Any Belgravia Drawing Room, went to my head when I was about 11 years old. Whistling intakes of breath. 999 actors unemployed for every one with a job, young fellow. How often would I hear this at drinks parties when I was a boy, such remarks always accompanied by the merest flash of a look, acutely designed to assure me that with a face and string-bean body like mine, I would never make a handsome leading man, and should perhaps think of some other career. Being a barrister is a little like being an actor, became my beaming mother's comforting and hopeful mantra. For a while, I went along with this, and between the ages of 12 and 15 would tell the Norfolk landowners and their wives to whose parties we came and went that I was all set to make it to the bar. Norman Burkitt's Six Great Advocates was now my constant companion, and with all the repulsive self-confidence of the lonely geek, I would bore my family with stories of the great forensic triumphs of Marshall Hall, my especial hero, and Rufus Isaacs, a great role model for any Jewish boy, since he rose to become Marquis of Reading and Viceroy of India. From a fruit market in Spitalfields to being curtsied and bowed at and called Your Highness in the Viceregal Palace of New Delhi. Imagine! And unlike Disraeli, a practising Jew. Not that I was ever that, nor were any of my mother's immediate family. We were, in Jonathan Miller's immortal words, not Jews, just Jewish. Not the whole hog. But then, as the Nazis showed, you don't have to practise. Even for 10,000 hours, at being Jewish, to be beaten, exiled, tortured, enslaved, or killed for it. So one might as well embrace the identity with pride. The rituals, genital mutilations, and avoidance of oysters and bacon can go hang, as can the behaviour of any given Israeli government, but otherwise consider me a proud Jew. My background and upbringing in rural Norfolk seem, from a 21st century perspective, a bizarre throwback. I think our way of life was in fact old-fashioned, even in its own time. A fish man every Wednesday clopping in by horse and cart. Coal trucks, butchers, grocers and bread vans arriving to deliver whatever provender that wasn't brought up to the back door by the gardeners for the cook, whose sister-in-law scrubbed floors on her knees 3 times a week. No central heating, no mains water, just coal or wood fires, and a Victorian pump house to draw up water, one source being a cistern reliant on soft rainwater which filled the tank that fed all the baths and wash basins with soft but rusty brown bathwater, the other source drawn up from a groundwater aquifer which supplied the house's single drinking water tap, fixed low down over a wooden bucket in a vast Victorian kitchen warmed only by a coke-fed aga. There was a china pantry, a food pantry, larders, sculleries, and an outer scullery with a huge butler's sink that could only be filled from a grand brass hand pump. Outside the china pantry, just by the door to the cellar stairs, hung a long rope which ended in a bulging red, white, and blue sally. If any of us children were out in the garden and were needed, the rope would be pulled. The clang of the bell could be heard 1/2 mile away, at the local pig farm, where I sometimes liked to spend my time ogling piglets. Every time I heard that bell, my stomach seemed to fill with lead, for unless it was lunch or supper time, it nearly always meant trouble. It clanged the news that somehow I had been found out and was required to stand on the carpet in front of the desk in my father's study and explain myself. Back inside again, on the wall next to the sally, was the predictable bell panel, which would have told servants from a previous era into which room to scuttle, bow, and bob for instructions. instead of the pulled-by-wire shaking bells so familiar from today's country house films or television series, ours, being an in-its-day modern Victorian house, took the form of a wooden-framed box. Each room's name was printed beneath a red star and a white circle, which oscillated when an electric bell was pressed. It was that my parents' house was one of the first in its part of Norfolk to be thoroughly on the electric. I'm sure the circuitry was never upgraded from the time of its building in the 1880s until my mother and father finally sold the place nearly a century and a half later. The ceramic fuse boxes, the solid Bakelite and brass 3 or 2 pin plugs were at least 80 years old when I was a boy in the 1960s, and I was always astonished by the eye-achingly dazzling white 3 pin plugs I saw in friends' houses, just as I was astonished by, and more than passingly envious of, the wall-to-wall carpeting, colour televisions, and warm radiators that my friends took for granted. Not to mention their easy access to cinemas, shops, and coffee bars. Such ordinary modern households as theirs may not have had trained plum and pear trees stapled to the gable ends of their outbuildings, nor could they boast built-in hand-carved linen-fold cupboards that a contemporary antiquarian would orgasm over, but they were, to my restless, rusticated brain, as exciting as my life and household was dull. We move along, as an estate agent would say, from the pantries and cellar door, past the bell panel and rope, and encounter an always closed, studded baize door, which leads through to the house proper. There, hallways, dining room, drawing room, great front stairs, and my father's study could be found. Forbidden territory. Next to the baize door were the back stairs, which led to our domain. On the third floor of the house, my brother and I each occupied a huge bedroom, leaving the others, one of which was already divided into two rooms, for furniture overspill, spare rooms, and attic space. These unfeasibly proportioned rooms, a little William Morris wallpaper still showing through in one of them, had originally been designed as dormitories for servants. Whitwell Elwin, the architect who built the house, had made the mistake earlier when building his own Victorian rectory in the same village of providing small individual rooms for his staff. It seems that in these narrow rooms they had suffered acutely from homesickness and loneliness, and thus, given a second chance at domestic architecture, Elwin had created in our house enormous servant chambers in which the maids and footmen, in their ruthlessly segregated dorms, naturally, could chatter and console each other through the night. Elwin's finest work of architecture was neither the rectory nor our house, but the village church. Booton Church is worth travelling miles to see. The Cathedral of the Villages, it has been called. Sir Nicholas Pevsner, the great master registrar of Britain's architecture, who visited every county and chronicled any building of worth in the United Kingdom, gave this chapter of my book its subheading when he described St. Michael the Archangel's in Booton as very naughty, but built in the right spirit. I remember quoting this observation of Pevsner's to John Betjeman when he came down to the church with a camera crew and some of his Victorian Society friends during one of my school holidays or rustication, temporary punishment suspension, periods. I'd been given the exciting job of escorting this distinguished party around, the self-appointed local expert, and telling them about the bath stone, the napped flint, the crocketed pinnacles, chamfering and idiomatic Gothic influences, and any other such pretentious guff as my mind, stuffed as it then was with prized Bannister Fletcher jargonese, could come up with. Note the influence of the Cluniac revival, that sort of gobshite. As if they didn't know all that, without the cocky pipings of a 12-year-old who behaved as if he was the professor of architecture at the Courthold. The great poet laureate, or were those years still ahead of him, was very friendly and patient about all this, but it was only years later that I learned that Betjeman and Pevsner were not on the most cordial of terms, despite each of them so valuing, and indeed so raising the value of, architecture in Britain. Perhaps, therefore, my quoting of Sir Nicholas had been injudicious. I spent the rest of the day, I remember, as a guest of the Victorian Society's formidably knowledgeable and likeable Hermione Hobhouse, diving in on unsuspecting Pugin and Gilbert Scott mini-masterpieces around the county. Whitwell Elwin may have created an astonishing church, but his major interest, outside one presumes his 51-year ministry at Bootin, was his editorship of the Quarterly Review, his querulous correspondence with fellow Victorian greats like Darwin and Gladstone, and his somewhat inappropriate relationships with a series of young girls, the most prominent of whom was his blessed girl, Lady Emily Bulwer-Lytton, a viceroy's daughter who later went on to marry the truly great architect Edwin Lutyens, best known for his creation of colonial New Delhi and his collaborations with the horticulturalist Gertrude Jekyll. Lutyens also designed Bootin Manor, described as an averagely fine example of his work. After building Bootin Church and its rectory, envious of Lutyens' superior talent, as well as jealous of his snaffling the beloved Emily, one supposes, Whitwell Elwin built our house as a thank you to the spinster sisters who had bankrolled his magnificent ecclesiastical folly. Just to drive home to you how preposterously old-fashioned a dwelling ours was, I should tell you that the lavatories were the boxed-in kind with a high-up cistern. Instead of the later decorated china pull-me chain, there had originally been a handle next to the bowl which you pulled up to flush. The wash-basin in the lavatory's anteroom didn't have a plug-hole. You pulled on a sprung tap to fill it, washed and rinsed your hands, tipped up a lip in the basin, which also served as the overflow slit, and the bowl pivoted to empty its water underneath before swinging back to its original position. You probably can't picture it, and I'm dissatisfied with my ability to convey its workings succinctly and clearly. Never mind. Similarly, the bathtub upstairs, with its great lion's claw feet, had a long cylindrical ceramic pole that you twisted and let down to seal the plug hole. It was also one of the few bathrooms I've ever known to possess a fireplace. My brother and I were only ever allowed to have a fire lit in our bedrooms if we were ill. I cannot overstate the pleasure of waking on a dark winter's morning and seeing the embers still glowing in the grate. Otherwise, in winter, one relied for warmth on a mountain of eiderdowns and blankets, or the company in bed of a cat or two. I had never even heard of a duvet or quilt. I once found a thin electric dimplex electric radiator in an attic, and brought it into my room. When my father discovered I had kept it, dialed up to maximum heat for 3 days in a row, the breath steaming from my mouth and nostrils was nonetheless visible, he made me sit down and work out, given the price of kilowatt hours, how much my profligacy had cost him. This was an arithmetical problem, of course, wildly beyond my competence. The radiator disappeared, and my fear of mathematics grew that much greater. Outside, the gardeners provided what the grocer, butcher, breadman, and fishman could not supply with their weekly van visits. Apples, pears, and potatoes were stored in outhouses over the winter. Jams, pickles, and chutneys were prepared in the autumn by the cook, Mrs. Riseborough. Lettuces, tomatoes, cucumbers, scarlet runner beans, broad beans, peas, marrows, asparagus in raised beds, figs, damsons, plums, cherries, greengages, strawberries, rhubarb, raspberry, and blackcurrant canes, and the whole rich bounty of the garden supplied us all. Milk was delivered daily in wax cartons, which, when dried, we used as kindling for the fireplaces. A local farm provided eggs and dark yellow butter, patted with carved wooden paddles and wrapped in greaseproof paper. I had never heard of or been into a supermarket before I was, I can't even guess what age. If we needed brambles for one of Mrs. Riseborough's blackberry and apple pies, I would take my baby sister Jo in her pushchair along a bridle path and pick the fruit by hand. The October mixing of the Christmas puddings and the pouring of the apple jelly. I'm sure that plenty of people still do this every year, more than ever before, perhaps, thanks to all the take-offs of the bake-offs and cake-offs that now take up most of our television schedules. Cream of tartar and crystallized angelica have never had it so good. Men and women, the length of the land, still grow vegetables, apples, pears, and soft fruits, too. I'm not, I hope, over-misting my own childhood idyll. Not that for me it was anything close to idyllic, much as it might and ought to appear to have been from this great distance in time and manners. A grass tennis court and even a badminton lawn were at our disposal. For whatever reason, we didn't use them much, only when American cousins visited. Behind the stable block was a cottage and separate garden where a couple who worked for my father lived, and next to that a paddock filled with noisy geese. I used to brave these hissingly aggressive birds to get to a walnut tree around which they honked and flapped as if it were a sacred temple being vandalized by heathens. Despite growing up in the country, I have never been fully at ease with wild animals. In the garden's overgrown old pigsty and hidden in a hedged area filled with broken sundials and choked ponds, my sister Jo and I found, tamed, and finally domesticated feral cats and kittens who had been let loose from the almost incredibly eccentric rector of the village church, who didn't, of course, as a high religionist, believe that animals possessed souls, and so they could therefore be happily thrown away like so much litter. Horses we did not have, for over the way my father had converted the monumentally solid stable block into a laboratory. He was a kind of designer, physicist and electronics engineer, impossible exactly to categorize. The stable mangers were filled with tools, the stalls with lathes, mills and other machinery, the vast upper rooms where the grooms might have slept housed oscilloscopes, ammeters and circuitry of the most curious and impenetrable kind. After 10 or 20 years of his work there, the smell of solder, swarfiga and freon finally overcame decades of dung, straw and saddle soap. Reefham, the nearest village to have proper shops and pubs, was over 3 miles away, and the inhabitants thought of my father, on the very rare occasions they caught sight of him, as the mad inventor. If, for some reason, he had to go in for a supply of tobacco, my mother having succumbed perhaps to a rare bout of influenza, he would stand in the post office, forlornly holding out money in the palm of his hand like a foreign tourist, allowing the correct amount to be picked out. I think he frightened the villagers a little, and that Wordsworth's real world of getting and spending frightened him too. Nothing like as much as he frightened me, however. In my mind he was a compound of Mr. Murdstone and Sherlock Holmes, with an element of the Famous Five's Uncle Quentin thrown in. Certainly he had the sinister, saturnine features and snarling intolerance of children that marked out the latter, and the almost inhuman brilliance and pipe-smoking gauntness of the great detective. It was Holmes himself who observed that genius was an infinite capacity for taking pains, and, awestruck and often filled with rage and hatred against him as I was, there was never a time that I didn't think my father an authentic genius. I still do. Between the ages of 7 and 19, however, I'm not sure I was ever able to look him in the eye, or to hear his disgruntled snorts and growls and sighs, without wanting to wet myself, or to fly from him in tears of humiliation and misery. Now in his 80s, he is building from scratch to his own design a 3D printer. I know him enough to be absolutely certain that when he has finished it, it will be more reliable and more elegantly designed than any other that currently exists on the market. My mother was and remains the warmest and kindest person you could know. Her first love and duty was, however, and always will be, to my father, and vice versa, which is as it should be. Their marriage always seemed to me to be so ideal that I often wonder if it completely spoiled my chances of achieving a relationship anything like as perfect. Which must be nonsense, since my brother and sister are both blissfully married. We will come to the squashier bogs, the more mephitically foul marshes of my useless and repulsive private life, later in this book, if you have the patience. Meanwhile, it's still catch-up time. One marvellous favour J.K. Rowling has done all English writers of a certain generation is to clarify this business of being sent off to school. No Hogwarts Express for the 7-year-old Stephen, of course, no butterbeers or magical chocolate frogs, but all in all, a really very similar affair otherwise. Boaters at the school end of the train were crammed on the heads or waved airily by impossibly mature-looking 12-year-olds. We new boys braced like mules and clutched onto our mothers as the prospect of months of separation in the company of these frightening-looking seniors approached.
"They'll think I look stupid. They'll think I look weedy. They'll think I look common."
All kinds of immature waves of inadequacy rolled over me. I'm not even sure that I knew what common meant. It was 2 years later, reading Nancy Mitford's indispensable noblesse oblige, that I discovered it turned out to be a word only ever used by common people in the first place, which is rather a lowering thought. Before Paddington Station was finally cleaned, rejigged and renovated 10 or so years ago, complete with a statue of its famous and noble bear, I could never go near the place without my bowels turning to water. Everybody else knew you ever meet, and this continues throughout life, is stronger than you are, knows the system better, and sees right through to the back of your brain and finds what it sees there to be wholly inadequate. Everyone you encounter carries, as it were, a huge club behind their back, while all you hold behind yours is a weedy cotton bud. I think I may have written this before, or possibly stolen it from someone else. It is, in any case, hardly a fresh observation, and I should be very surprised if it does not strike home with you. The rest of the world was at that lesson, the one we missed because of a toothache or diarrhea, the one where they, the rest of the school, were told how the world works and how to comport themselves with confidence and ease. We all missed it and have felt insecure ever since. Other people know some secret thing, and no other people know more than children who are just a few years older than you are. To go to a prep school 200 miles away at the age of 7 seems like the fish cart, the 1880s servant's bell, or the cook receiving vegetables from cap-doffing gardeners, madly silly, English, grand and old-fashioned. You should know, then, before I go any further, that contrary to the implication of all that has gone before, we were poor. Not dirt poor, not peasant poor, obviously, just poor compared to all the kinds of people who sent their sons to the same kinds of schools. Poor compared to the kinds of people my parents had to dinner parties. Yes, dinner parties where the men wore black tie and the women withdrew from the dining room to the drawing room after the cheese to allow the men time for strong talk, cigars and port. My mother confided in me her probably accurate opinion that this old and now defunct ritual, defunct even in royal palaces, I am able to tell you, more of that later too, was in fact a way of allowing women to go to bathrooms together without drawing the attention of their men to the fact that the sweet creatures possessed such things as bladders, which needed voiding just as much as any man's or horse's did. We were poor in that my mother drove an ancient Austin A35 with flicky uppy indicators, and my father an Austin 1800 from the heyday of British motoring incompetence, after he had driven an old Rover 90 into desuetude. We never went on holidays, and every time my mother and I went into a shoe or clothing shop throughout my childhood and adolescence, I remember squirming and writhing with embarrassment as she complained, very loudly to my ears, that such and such a pair of shoes were shatteringly expensive, and that she couldn't possibly afford those trousers. I did grow very fast, of course, and she had a small budget from which to buy anything. The school fees themselves, somehow we found ourselves, my brother and I, going to two not wildly grand private schools that were nonetheless just about the most expensive of any in England, were paid for, I am certain, by my mother's father, the beloved Jewish immigrant who died when I was about 10, and whom I wish, greatly wish, I had known better. But I grew up with a quite illusory, entitled, as we would now say, sense of aggrieved deprivation. To confess this is deeply embarrassing. How could I possibly feel deprived? Just how cheap must I have been to think a country house with servants and grand rooms was horrible, and that a modern house with colour televisions, gas ovens, freezer cabinets, carpets and central heating was a lost dream of luxury. There we are, then, off to a prep school in Gloucestershire, far from Norfolk, but beautiful too in its own way. I wrote in the Fry Chronicles about my insatiable appetite for sweets. I devoted pagefuls of panegyrics to the tuck shop and provided pagefuls too of self-reproach for the thieving and sly manipulations that my addiction to all things sugary led me to. I suppose they themselves derived from this sense of being hard done by, wherever the hell that came from. Maybe sugar stood in for a parental love or the domestic prosperity that I felt deprived of. Perhaps I was born with one of those narcissistic fantasy minds, the kind that believes they really are the abandoned son of a duke, or that a solicitor's letter will one day arrive informing them of an unknown cousin's fabulous will, of which they are to be sole benefactor. The Crown Courts are daily full of such sad people. I happen to be that rare thing, rarer than a straight man in a Hollister T-shirt, a fantasist whose fantasies came true, it would seem. A lot of celeb haters would say that most celebs are narcissists. It could be that they are right. Counterintuitively, self-hatred is one of the leading symptoms of clinical narcissism. Only by telling yourself and the world how much you hate yourself can you receive the reliable shower of praise and admiration in response that you feel you deserve. Or so at least the theory runs. I survived prep school just. Stouts Hill School, now a holiday resort, was a marvellous mid-18th century Strawberry Hill Gothic Revival Rococo, if you can have such a mixture, castellated fantasy, complete with catacombs and crenellations, a butler, Mr. Deely, and entirely strange characters, such as a Mr. Sawton, whose hands shook uncontrollably and whom we imitated without mercy. It was only in my last year that one of the masters told me that Sawdon had been a brilliant youth, an authentic war hero, his mind shattered by shell shock in the trenches of Flanders, an experience from which he had never recovered. If I think now of the ho-ho number of times I would creep behind him, imitating his flicking, quivering hands, his slack jaw, his drivelling mutters, his drooling and his weaving, dipping gait, him all unaware, the boys in front watching me over his shoulder and squealing with laughter. If I think of that now, I want to stick a pen through my throat in shame. What made it all the worse was the memory I have that his face would light up whenever he saw laughter. He believed, I suppose, that he was looking at affection and pleasure, and some distant image stirred in him of a happy life of laughter and friendship before the bone-splintering, mind-ravaging war that destroyed everything he had been. Just about 99% of the times that he saw a smiling face, he wasn't looking at the smiles of friends. He was peering unawares at the mocking grins of young fiends who thought him weird and retarded and worthy of nothing but contempt. All the time I was there, he was deliberately tormented, impersonated, and cruelly teased almost daily. It is no use my apologizing now. He would be 120 were he still alive, I expect. But I weep as I write this, weep at my own callous, ignorant and ostentatious viciousness, and weep for the hundreds and thousands of Sawtons who didn't even have the shelter of a school folded in the soft green wolds of Gloucestershire to give them a home. Mr. Sawton was, I think, somehow related by marriage to the founder and headmaster of the school, Robert Angus. Angus had three daughters, each of whom was more or less nutty about horses, especially Jane, the youngest. Our star alumnus had been Mark Phillips, already in training for the Mexico Olympics as an equestrian and later to marry Princess Anne. Riding at Stouts Hill was not an extra like bassoon lessons or fencing, but part of the everyday curriculum. One would descend from a double Latin class to the stables for an equally serious, and to me much duller, lesson in the arcana of equestrianism. I can still recite the Pommels, Martingales, Snaffles, Pelhams, Gags, Kimblewick and Liverpool bits, even something called a Chifney anti-rearing bit, if I recall correctly, girth straps and curry combs, whose every detail and proper use we had to master before we were ever allowed so much as to mount a pony. The smell of saddle soap and dubbin, rarely encountered by me these days, is as intense and evocative as the smell of creosote, cloves or candy floss. I think of myself, despite an assumption amongst some that I am intellectual, rationalist, and almost coldly logical, as an emotional, sensual being, led far more by the heart and other organs than by the brain. Smell, as we all know, evokes the past more immediately than any of the other four senses. Where the aroma of saddle soap takes me, your grandmother's lily-of-the-valley hand lotion, or the sweat and mud reek of the school changing rooms, might take you. In 2009, I swore, not in the sense of using foul language, although I had muttered plenty of that off-camera, that the day I was nearly thrown by a skittering Tennessee walking horse would be the last time anyone would ever, ever see me on top of a horse until my dying day. This incident had taken place while filming a documentary series in which I visited each state of the American Union. The humiliation of arranging the title sequence of Blackadder Goes Forth had already more or less determined me never to sit atop an equine again. We had shot the sequence down at the Royal Anglian Regiment's HQ in Colchester, and the idea was that I, as the blithering General Melchett, would bestride my mount and take salute, while the band, led by Captain Blackadder and attended by poor old Private Baldrick, along with Hugh Laurie's nobly asinine Lieutenant George and Tim McInerney's twitchy Captain Darling, marched past, eyes right, to the stirring march, The British Grenadiers, which then morphed into Howard Goodall's Blackadder theme tune. For practice, I got my foot into the stirrup of the Colonel's mount, whose name I think was, and this should have warned me, Thunderbolt, swung into the saddle and walked experimentally forwards, clucking and chitching in a way that would have built up confidence and amiability in a Tyrannosaurus who had just heard bad news from his bank. I had walked about the whole parade ground, feeling more or less confident, cooing Thunderbolt's name, stroking his muzzle, softly patting his flanks, and giving him the news that he was safe and that I loved him. Thunderbolt and I now stood peacefully awaiting the moment. Cameras, action, and cue music. The moment the first blare of the trumpet sounded, Thunderbolt reared, neighed like a banshee, pawed the air, and galloped around the parade ground as if stung by a gadfly. None of this was helped by Hugh, all but falling to the ground, heaving with such uncontrollable laughter that he could scarcely breathe. I was 8.5 feet at least from solid concrete, holding on for dear life. My friend thought it was the funniest thing he had ever seen in his life. Men. So you may well imagine that 20 years later in the southern states of America, the prospect of heaving my carcass on a Tennessee walking horse was causing me a little perturbation. It was Georgia we were investigating at this stage in our documentary series on the 50 states, and we were the guests of a very kind family who lived in a plantation house that didn't seem to have changed since the days of Scarlett O'Hara. It was clear that my discomfort in the presence of horses transmitted itself. "Now, don't you go worrying about her," my amiable hostess had reassured me with a delicious, high-class southern drawl. "There never was born a horse so docile." That last word pronounced, of course, in the American way, as you just heard, as if to rhyme with fossil, or that turdine melodic songbird, the throstle. Yes, isn't turdine a splendid word? Anyway, back to that docile animal. "That's all very well," I remember gasping as I tried to heave my bulk onto its back. "But horses and I never get on, which is why I never get on horses. They know that I don't like them, and they always panic." Even at my initial gentle, reasonable, unhurried, clucking, apple-offering, muzzle-nuzzling approach, the beast's ears had instantly drawn back. The flanks had pricked and twitched, and the hooves had stamped as if it had detected Satan in me. "Not this one, hon," came the complacent, murmured reply. 5 minutes later, just in time for the camera to catch my humiliation, the walking horse freaked out at the horror of having me astride it, or possibly, like every fucking horse ever fucking born, became utterly spooked by the astounding existence of such wholly unexpected and terrifying phenomena as wind, trees, sky, a bird gliding in the distance, a chicken, a hedge, a leaf whirling in the wind, a butterfly, you name it, and galloped off, bursting through the corral fence while I screamed and juddered in the saddle, incompetently trying to operate the brakes. "Well, I declare, she's never done that in her life." You would think a prep school laid out in idyllic countryside with a lake, woods, spinneys and rolling parkland, and where the riding of biddable and patient ponies was compulsory, might have prepared me for at least normal human competence on horseback. The school achieved this for me no more than it prepared me for normal human competence at life. Just as I can't and never could ride horses, I can't and never could live. At least, I have never felt I could. So, this is still for the new subscribers, I should warn. I survived 6 years of prep school and moved at the age of 13 to Uppingham, an old-fashioned public school set in the glorious county of Rutland. It was here that, to contradict Philip Larkin, love fell on me like an enormous no. Most of my life since has been a response to that. Fortunately, however, there had been books. I will leap backwards a little to Bouton and myself at an earlier age, just to explain the effect that books had had on me by the time I arrived at big school. I relish all things digital, but if I had been born 25 years later, I dread to think of how little I would know about the written word. I'm not so foolish as to join myself with those heralds of doom who claim that the internet and social networking will inevitably spell the death of literacy, literature, focus, concentration span, or real human interaction. When moving type printing was invented, it was damned as a technology that would rot mind. No longer would a scholar have to know everything, they could just look it up. When the novel arrived, it was damned as destructive, escapist, shallow, and detrimental to morals. The same howls of protest were screeched at popular theatre, music hall, cinema, then television, video gaming, and now social networking. Human teenagers in particular are tougher than their elders will ever believe. The bullying, abuse, and trolling is, of course, horrific. But believe me, a teenager has a better life of it now than he or she ever did 100 years ago, when physical punishment, cruel sadistic beatings, and sexual abuse went unquestioned in schools and in the home. As it was, my father, who was from the radio, or wireless, as it was then called, generation, thought televisions were perhaps permissible for showing events like Churchill's funeral, moon landings, or serious news stories. But otherwise, our little black-and-white set at home was relegated to the corner of the kitchen, its aerial being just a wire poked in the rear antenna socket and blue-tacked to the wall. My mother pasted a cut-out newspaper cartoon on the television's side. A housewife is explaining to her friend, "Oh, we had one of the very first colour sets, but the colours have faded now." Insomnia, especially on hot nights, was one of the chief miseries of my childhood and youth. The only answer, therefore, was to read, which in itself presented an absurd problem. If I opened the windows to cool the room, it would soon fill with huge moths, maybugs, junebugs, and all kinds of simply terrifying arthropods peculiar to Norfolk, which, like crazed winged lobsters, would caroom and careen straight to my bedside lamp and flicker, bang, and buzz about inside the shade. I happened to be horribly afraid of moths, an utterly irrational fear, I'm quite aware, but agonizingly real. Somehow I managed, despite these abhorred, fluttering distractions, to get through hundreds of books a year. My parents had many of their own, most of which I had soon consumed more than once. I further supplemented my reading matter, at first from a large grey mobile library, which arrived every other Thursday at the corner of two lanes, not far from the house. I'm not sure such services still operate. It seems doubtful. Councils these days seem disobliged so much as to resurface a road, educate a child, or empty a dustbin. One Sunday afternoon, aged 12, while my father was safely at work in the stable block over the way, I watched on the little television Anthony Asquith's film version of The Importance of Being Earnest. I vividly recall sitting on an uncushioned wooden kitchen chair, face flushed, mouth half open, simply astonished at what I was watching, and most especially, hearing. I had had simply no idea that language could do this, that it could dance and trip and tickle, cavort, swirl, beguile and seduce, that its rhythms, subclauses, repetitions, clausuli and colours could excite quite as much as music. When Algernon says to Cicely, "I hope, Cicely, I shall not offend you if I state quite frankly and openly that you seem to me to be in every way the visible personification of absolute perfection," I wriggled and giggled and repeated the phrase to myself in disbelieving bliss, enough times to commit it to memory there and then. I would repeat it solemnly to the faintly bewildered Mrs. Riseborough. "Oh, you do go on with your nonsense. How that drive Nanny crazy." By this time, Mrs. Riseborough had been promoted to the role of nanny to my sister, something she considered a great advancement, although she still cooked, ironed, and performed innumerable other jobs around the house, and thenceforth would much rather be called Nanny Riseborough than Mrs. Riseborough. Her Christian name, Dolly, was used only by her immediate family, although her husband Tom, who had after all given her the name, preferred to call her, in Janeite Dickensian fashion, Mrs. Riseborough. She died only last year, aged almost 100. I had visited her a few times over the years, but deeply regret missing her funeral. I'm not sure that such combinations of independence, strength, and unquestioning service still exist. Her son Peter came to own a very successful and popular Norfolk gastropub called the Rat Catchers. Rather than sitting at a table and enjoying a little sip or a well-earned bowl of soup, his mother would insist on washing up in the kitchen behind the bar, right through into her 90s. That day, years before, my repeatedly telling her that I hoped I would not offend her if I stated quite frankly and openly that she seemed to me to be in every way the visible personification of absolute perfection, might have flustered her a little, but she was used to my behaviour, which was at times so frantic, fanciful and foolish that it would today quite certainly be diagnosed as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Wilde's phrase, and many others from the film, "Sicily, you will read your political economy in my absence. The chapter on the fall of the rupee you may omit. It is somewhat too sensational," took hold of me completely. In an age before video recording, the best I could do was imagine myself inside the world of this extraordinary motion picture, which turned out, my mother told me, after, of course, patiently enduring the matter of her too being the visible personification of absolute perfection, to have been based on a play, a copy of which, she was sorry to say, was not in the house. The following Thursday, I stood then the only customer, lender, user, what was the word then? Fretfully at the corner of the lanes, waiting for the battleship grey mobile library to hove into view. The driver lurched the van,